Call the Senate Finance Meeting to order. This on his own cell phone. The time is 9:05 in the afternoon on Monday, May 8th, 2023. I'm joined by Co-Chair Hoffman, Co-Chair Stedman, Senator Bishop, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, and Senator Wilson will be by shortly. He's here, just not in the room at this time. We're going to hear two bills this morning. Senate Bill 140 by Senator Hoffman, and Senate Bill 48 by the Governor. This is the first hearing for Senate Bill 140, which is the broadband bill in schools by Senator Hoffman. Senator Hoffman will introduce the bill with his aide, Martin Borio. Please come up to the table. If you walk us through the sectional as well. The goal is to be done in 10 or 15 minutes. Ms. Borio, please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. My name is Meriden Borio. For the record, staff to Senator Hoffman. SB 140, an act relating to funding for internet services for school districts and providing for an effective date, will increase broadband for eligible schools from 25 megabits per second to 100 megabits per second of download speed, and provide funding to assist those schools reach the higher speed through the School Broadband Assistance Grant, or the BAG. The Alaska School Broadband Assistance Grant Program was created in 2014 to assist schools to reach download speeds of 10 megabits per second. In 2020, the legislature revised the statute to help schools reach 25, and SB 140 will increase the download speeds to 100.
Ms. Borio, if I could just make a suggestion.
Yes.
I have to go quite so fast.
Okay.
You're starting to burn my bearings out here, so go ahead with your presentation.
Apologize, Mr. Chairman. The Universal Service Administrative Company Schools and Libraries Program, commonly known as E-Rate, is a federal program that provides funding to eligible schools to obtain affordable internet access. Schools qualify for the E-Rate discount, then may apply for the School Broadband Assistance Grant. The E-Rate program provides discounts of up to 90% to help eligible schools and libraries obtain affordable broadband. The School Broadband Assistance Grant, the BAG, helps make up the rest. In 2023, 151 Alaskan schools and 27 school districts benefited from the School BAG awards. The increase proposed in SB 140 will allow for better and faster connectivity for schools to stay current in the modern world and ensure that Alaskan schools aren't left behind as internet technology becomes ever more vital to education. Thank you for hearing the bill this morning, and I'll attempt to answer any questions.
Do we have any questions by members of the committee for Ms. Borio? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Borio, good morning. Looking at the statute around this, without this change, if a remote district wants to get above the 25, are they able to get help with the high costs of maintaining that 25, or does all help go away when they break that sort of, is that a ceiling right now?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, no, they still qualify for the E-rate discounts through the federal government. They just, if they pass 25, the state doesn't provide any additional funding.
So,
follow up, sir?
Just to make sure I'm clear, the state, does the state provide any partial match to that E-rate? To the 25?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, only if the school is already past 25, is that your question? I apologize. Then no.
Okay. That got me there, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
I forgot to ask comments by the bill's sponsor, Senator Hoffman.
There's been some question about the fiscal note, since this is such a big leap. The committee may want to change the effective date. This is not to say that we're asking for this to be implemented during this school year, but with the advent of 5G and all the funds that are going out throughout the state of Alaska, we want to make sure that we have a system that's being built that will bring us to the forefront of broadband throughout the nation. And we should also follow suit and look at raising the E-rate from 25 to 100, and the consideration of what level we will be funding that can be decided by the next legislature, the one thereafter. But I think it's important for us as a state to continue marching forward, since we have such a large state with school districts spread across such a vast territory that the states and the dependence on education and the internet is so critical. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman, I guess one other question I have for you. Do you have support from the administration on this bill for the schools that are out there, or shall we have the acting commissioner of education come up and address the question?
You can ask the department.
Okay.
But I think it's such a big policy issue that we as the legislature should be taking the lead.
And I think we'll go ahead and ask some of the more specific fiscal questions to the people as we go over the fiscal notes with the people for administration. Any further questions by members of the committee for Ms. Borio or Senator Hoffman? Matt, thank you very much for coming up this morning. Do you have any public testimony on this? We do have public testimony on it? Okay. We'll open public testimony now. Ms. Willie Kimball? Oh, I'm sorry. We have people in the room that want to go ahead and testify. Go ahead. Come on up and identify yourself for the record. We've got a two-minute limit here, so please go ahead with your record. And if you have something written, we'd be glad to go ahead and take it as well.
Good morning. Thank you, Co-Chair Olson. For the record, my name is Christine O'Connor. I am the Executive Director of Alaska Telecom Association. I'd like to thank Co-Chair Hoffman for sponsoring this bill and the committee for hearing it this morning. I'm also a lifelong Alaskan and a graduate of Moose Pass Elementary School, Dillingham High School, and Alaska Pacific University. So it's a particular pleasure to testify in support of SB 40 Internet for our Alaska schools this morning. Ms. Borio did a great recap of the power of the school bag program, which has tripled internet speeds for our smallest rural schools since it began in 2014. However, there's still quite a ways to go. Fortunately, we are in a truly transformational period for Alaska's broadband infrastructure. We have major projects going online as we speak, over $600 million in federal investment, and over $50 million in matching from our in-state Alaska broadband providers means that new internet capability is becoming available for schools. So an update to the school bag program will allow these schools to take advantage of connecting as these new networks reach their communities, which is already happening. Some of the reasons this is important, when you think about a 25 megabit speed, it's a good for online guides will tell you about two people and five devices. So when you think about an entire school sharing that connectivity, you do run into problems with buffering, having to turn off video during video calls. I think we probably all experienced this over the last 3 years. Bumping that speed to 100 megabits is transformational. You will be able to not only do video calling, you'll be able to do online assessments, online testing, access all of the online resources that teachers and students should have the advantage of accessing. I'm happy to answer questions, mostly here this morning to express my support for the bill and to thank you for hearing and sponsoring the bill.
Mr. O'Connor, thank you very much for coming up this morning. Any questions by members of the committee for Ms. O'Connor? If not, we'd like to have Heidi Tischner, the Acting Commissioner of Education, come on up and go ahead and give her perspective on that.
Good morning. For the record, Heidi Teschner, Acting Commissioner, Department of Education, Early Development, and it's good to see you guys this morning. The Senate Bill 140, obviously, as you discussed, would increase school broadband assistance to eligible school districts, which would bring in additional federal revenue to districts through the E-rate program, and that obviously supportive of additional educational opportunities for students.
Is that all you got to say for it?
Right now, yes. Available for questions.
Can I ask this question? Can I ask you the question I asked Senator Hoffman? Is the department in favor of the bill?
The administration is in favor of additional ensuring that we have adequate education for our students, especially in our rural areas. So this is one aspect to help increase that within our rural school districts, especially.
Thank you very much. Next we have up is Lacey Sanders. While you're here, would you mind covering the fiscal note for those of us that are less familiar with it, and we may have questions about it as well?
Absolutely. Please. Good morning. For the record, my name is Lacey Sanders, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Education and Early Development, and we have Dr. Amy Phillips-Chan here also with us for some more technical details as well. So just to start, we have the fiscal note for SB 140, and at the top it has OMB component number 3004. An additional appropriation of $20,139,200 is the estimated additional need for the increase from 25 megabits per second to 100 megabits per second. And this is based on an estimate that was developed based on currently having 151 schools eligible and increasing that by 108 additional schools. The department uses the FCC's open data platform to gather the information on where schools are at currently to project what would be needed potentially under 100 megabits per second. And we're happy to answer any other questions.
Do you have any questions from members of the committee for Ms. Sanders? No, thank you very much for going over that. Dr. Chen, please. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Excuse me. Good morning. Thank you, Chair Olson. I'm happy to be here. For the record, Dr. Amy Phillips-Chan, Director of the Alaska State Libraries, Archives, and Museums, and I am here primarily this morning to help answer questions regarding SB 140 and its impact, fiscal impact. Thank you.
Do we have any? Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have a question, I guess, for the department in terms of some of these past funding awardees for FY23 and FY21. I see one of the large rural school districts is not on here. Just wondering if they just need assistance, and that's the Lower Yukon. That's the question.
Ms. Chen, do you want to answer that, or should we have it go over to the somebody on the administrative level?
Yeah, through the chair. Thank you, Senator Wilson, for the question. So you're wondering about the Lower Kuskokwim School
Yukon.
District, Lower Yukon School District, and if they could benefit from having increased internet speeds beyond 25 megabits per second?
No, I just don't see them being a awardee on the list, and just wondering why, or if they're already past that, or do they need some technical assistance in applying for these funds? As they're a large rural school district, and I just don't want the chair to speak for his own school district.
Sure.
Both chairs share that school district.
Thank you for the question, Senator Wilson. Regarding Lower Yukon Kuskokwim School District, I believe they are listed as Lower Kuskokwim on the list.
Ms. Chen, first of all, I don't think it's the Yukon Lower Yukon Kuskokwim School District. It's just the Lower Yukon School District.
Yes, two different school districts.
They're two different school districts.
Chair Olson.
I'm sorry. Commissioner Teschner.
For the record, Heidi Teschner. Through the chair, Senator Olson, I don't know off the top of my head Lower Yukon's download speeds, but they very well could be over the 25, which is why you're not seeing them on the list, because they technically won't qualify. We can follow up with the committee on their exact download speed, but it is a voluntary program, and not all districts are required to participate. But it's very likely they're above the 25 megabits.
Thank you very much, Mr. Teschner. Any other questions by members of the committee first?
Yeah, I just quick follow up.
Sure, follow up, Senator Wilson.
I just don't think that's possible. I think that maybe they just might just, I just want to know why they didn't apply, or if they just didn't know about the program, or just technical assistance. But I severely doubt that they're all those schools are over the 25. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions by members of the committee for the three young ladies up here? If not, thank you very much for coming up. Next we have up is Dr. Lisa Parity. Ms. Parity, please come up, identify yourself for the record, and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Dr. Lisa Parity. I am the Executive Director of the Alaska Council of School Administrators. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to briefly testify in support of SB 140. Specifically, I want to thank Senator Hoffman for bringing this bill. By way of background, I was on the North Slope as assistant superintendent and acting superintendent for 6 years, and it was at that point that I approached Senator Olson and Senator Hoffman and our representatives in the House to look at some way for us to increase connectivity for our students who at that point on the North Slope in, say, I think it was 2008, were having 1 meg, 2 meg, maybe 3 megs. And we came up with this solution at that point, and in 2014 passed the first broadband assistant grant for 10 megs to lift the floor across rural Alaska. And as you know, 30% of our students are off the road system, 30% of our schools. And so this was a huge help to those teachers, but 10 megs is certainly not enough. And so a couple years ago, we again incrementally lifted that floor to 25 megs. So we've been doing that over the course of the years using the huge leverage we get through the E-rate federally. And so this bill, I think, comes back again to incrementally lift this to 100, which is, in essence, an industry standard. Our current is of 25 megs is around 1970s speeds, and while that is much better than 10, it's certainly not adequate, as we saw through the COVID pandemic. And so the one thing I'll highlight is with the pandemic and in our school district's efforts to serve our students, we still really had the haves and the have-nots. And those districts who are in our most rural and remote areas, in many cases, had to do paper and pencil packets instead of serve our students virtually. So this is just yet the next step in equity for our students in rural Alaska. Our members, superintendents, all principals, school business officials, and those serving our students across the state are 100% behind this, and we appreciate your consideration of it. Really, geography should not determine connectivity for our students. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much for coming out this morning. Next we have up is Lon Garrison. Mr. Garrison, please.
Good morning, members of the Senate Finance Committee. Chairman Olson, my name is Lon Garrison. I serve as the Executive Director of the Association of Alaska School Boards. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 140 and the positive effects that it would have on public education throughout the state of Alaska. The Association of Alaska School Boards membership has a resolution passed on this particular issue relating to educational technology. And one of the elements of that resolution speaks about strongly encouraging state leadership by virtue of student rights to be equitable educational opportunity and ensure that all classrooms are provided affordable, equitable, and broadband access to the national and international information infrastructure. So along with the idea of equity in terms of funding for school districts across the state and having students gain equitable opportunities to an excellent education every day, broadband access is the next big equitable question mark that we have. And Senate Bill 140 would go a long ways in terms of helping to address that issue. And just as Senator Wilson pointed out, you know, a school district like Lower Yukon, it's hard to imagine that they don't have challenges in many of their schools along with everybody else. So I urge you to pass this. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming out this morning. Next we have up is Errol Burr from Quintillion. Mr. Burr, are you on, sir? If Mr. Burr's not on, we'll go to Jim Wilson, Superintendent of Unalaska Schools. Mr. Wilson, are you on, sir?
Hello?
Go ahead.
Hi, this is Ariel Burr. I'm here.
Is Mr. Wilson on? Ms. Burr, go ahead with your testimony, please.
Good morning, members of the Senate Finance Committee. My name is Ariel Burr, and I work at Quintillion. I'm here to speak in support of SB 140 to increase funding to help schools upgrade their internet speeds to a minimum of 100 megabits. This is a crucial step for the future of education in Alaska. The National Telecommunications and Information Agency, NTIA, defines unserved households as not having access to reliable broadband service with a minimum of 100 megabits per second. For community anchor institutions like schools and hospitals, it is 1 gigabit per second, which is 10 times 100 megabits per second. This is expected to increase over time as the use of and dependence on technology continues to grow. We live in a world where technology plays a vital role in every aspect of our lives. It is how we communicate, how we learn, and how we work. And yet, many schools in rural Alaska are still struggling with slow internet speeds that make it difficult for students to access the resources they need to succeed. By upgrading to a minimum of 100 megabits per second, we can ensure that our students have the same opportunities as their peers across the country. They will be able to participate in online classes, access educational materials, and collaborate with students from other schools with broadband speeds that result in a quality experience. This is a significant step towards bridging the digital divide and increasing digital equity for all Alaskans. Quintillion stands ready to work with the state of Alaska and the legislature to further improve digital equity for all Alaskans, regardless of where they live or their socioeconomic status. This bill is not just about keeping up with the national standards. It's about investing in our students and giving them the tools they need to succeed in the 21st century. With faster internet speeds, we can create a more equitable education system that provides every student with a chance to learn and grow. I urge you to support this bill and invest in the future of Alaska students. Let us make sure that no student is left behind because of slow internet speeds. Thank you.
Ms. Burr, thank you very much for coming out this morning. Next we have up is Jim Wilson, Superintendent of Unalaska Schools. Mr. Wilson, are you on, sir?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Wilson. I'm Superintendent of Unalaska City School District, and I'm representing the students and staff of my community. I'm here testifying in support of SB 140. Thank you to Dr. Parody for speaking earlier. I think she hit it right on the head. This is a have and have not situation, and most of rural Alaska, quite frankly, is in the have nots. I just don't think that's acceptable in our great state that values rural communities and rural education in the way that we do. And we've heard a lot about what is the recommended speed. The FCC actually recommends 1 megabyte per student, for broadband students in rural Alaska, but more specifically in my community of Unalaska, operate at about 0.125, one-tenth of a megabyte per student. What does this mean? It's kind of like dial-up speed. It means that students can't stream a video to help with a math lesson. They can't access needed support materials that are available for curriculum for virtually everybody else in the state. And we can't adequately complete state-mandated testing. We just finished up the Alaska Peaks testing, and it took us about 4 weeks to complete state testing for the Alaska Star, rather, just because we had to rotate students through because students couldn't test at the same time. And so what does that mean? That means that education, comes to a slow crawl at best as we're trying to complete state testing because of inadequate bandwidth speed. So, it's just there's some real challenges out here in rural Alaska that I know Senator Hoffman and the others are aware of. And being able to have internet speeds upwards of 100 megabytes per second will help us to have the same availability and just access to digital equity that all other communities have. So thank you for your consideration in considering this bill, and I look forward to hopefully hearing that it passes and having better access for rural Alaska. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Wilson, thank you very much for coming out this morning. Next we have up is Willie Keppel. Mr. Keppel, are you on, sir?
Yes, good morning, Senate Finance. I live in Quinhawk, and I've been talking to a bunch of ITs that I know across the state here, some of them through the school districts, others work for local rural communities at the city levels. And your problem is that nobody's actually putting anything into costs here. I hear a lot of, yeah, we're in support of this, and I'm always in support of having two boat motors. One breaks down, I have another, and that's the situation we're in here. You're looking at the most expensive boat motor if you want to look at this program right here. When you look at Starlink, when I talk to these ITs, they're going, holy, the price is, and speed differences are so huge, it's not even comparable. But the problem is that we're stuck to the federal government's grant programs, and that brings us into the universal services USAC, which pays 90%. They dictate that you can't, a school district out here can't have two types of internet. You can have one or the other. You're picking the most expensive. You're going with the one that's going to take 6 to 7 years to get laid out here. When I walk around this village, Quinhawk's 400 miles from the road system, so we're as remote as any other. Almost every house in this community has a Starlink on it for 90 bucks a month. With unlimited, I can stream TV 24/7. I have cable that costs me 60 channels, and I pay 16 bucks a month for that. And when you talk to the ITs, here's where they're going. You're looking at Anchorage prices, and I don't think a lot of legislators understand the difference when you're looking at 1,000 megabytes of GCI Red program. It's 200 bucks a month in Anchorage. Out here, that same 200 megabits is 200,000 a month. There's your differences, and 10% of this, the state picks up. That's part of the package that the state has to pick up.
You want to go ahead and have your final comments?
Yes, start looking at Starlink as a second option and getting our federal legislators, our three that are there, to go deal with USAC to allow us to have.
Thank you very much for coming out this morning. We appreciate your comments. If you have written comments, please send them on in. Next we have up is anybody else on line for public testimony? But I'd like to have final comments from the bill sponsor, Mr. Senator Hoffman.
No, thank you. I think the testimony provides the importance of this to have the availability for rural Alaska to move into this next century. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll be setting this bill aside, so if anybody has any further comments, if anybody wants to go ahead and testify, please send them on to the Senate Finance Committee. All at ease. Taking at ease while we're at it. Senate Finance Committee back to order. Next bill up in its first hearing is Senate Bill 48, the Carbon Offset Program by the Governor. This morning we have, and we want to welcome Commissioner John Boyle, the Director of Natural Resources. Mr. Boyle, are you on, sir?
Thank you, Co-Chair Olson. Can you hear me?
Coming in loud and clear. Go ahead with your presentation and then whatever assistance you want to come on up and present for you.
Yes, sir. Well, good morning, Co-Chair Olson, members of the committee. This is John Boyle, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Natural Resources, for the record. It's a privilege to be in front of you this morning to introduce SB 48, our carbon offset program on state lands bill. And in the administration's perspective, this bill represents what we believe one of the best opportunities for the state to utilize its existing resource base to diversify our economy and increase state revenue through carbon management. Our resource base in the state really, in our, I should add, our expansive state land holdings really give us a competitive advantage over many other jurisdictions. With tens of millions of acres that we have of state lands which are forested and roughly 60 million acres of submerged lands or tidelands, we have myriad opportunities to capitalize on what is a rapidly growing industry. And a logical question is, you know, what is driving this growth? And I think if you were to look at many of the companies that comprise the S&P 500 index, you would note that many of them, if not most at this point, have established some sort of net zero target or other carbon-related benchmarks that they hope to reach by a date certain, whether that be 2030, 2040, 2050, et cetera. And while some of these companies can employ new technologies to reduce their emissions, you know, many will have to look at carbon offset projects in order to continue to be in business and to grow their businesses, but also to meet their net zero goals. And so this is why we're seeing a lot of analysts in this space predict that the carbon offset market will grow by tens of billions of dollars or more over the next few decades. And what I think is really exciting as far as opportunities here in the state is that carbon offset projects will give existing industries more economic incentive and add a measure of benefit that will enable these programs to move forward. So if we think, for instance, of the timber industry, and I'm speaking particularly about interior Alaska, we have an incredible land base. We have the Tanana Valley State Forest. We have, again, all of the forested lands that we see in South Central Alaska and other areas across the state. But we have a very mom-and-pop oriented sort of timber industry, particularly as we look up here in the interior. And so what can carbon offsets programs provide for that kind of industry? And that really amounts to enhanced forest management, really looking at our forests as an asset, which right now I would say that we manage our forests more for mitigating wildfire risk than many other activities. We don't spend a lot of money enhancing what kind of trees are growing on our lands. We're not spending a lot of money researching tree genetics and other things to improve the tree stocks that we have growing. We basically let nature run its course. And the result of that has been, you know, here in South Central, we've seen tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of acres that have now succumbed to the spruce bark beetle. And we have stocks and stands of trees that really aren't of high quality. They're really not very merchantable in a lot of applications. And so through carbon offset projects, as we consider managing lands for carbon offset purposes, we can start to think about managing those lands as well to increase the merchantability of the timber that's growing on those lands, so that as opposed to just allowing nature to run its course and treat, you know, various random trees to kind of grow willy-nilly, we could be more focused and decide that in certain areas we want to, for instance, ensure that we have stands of white spruce that are growing, and that, you know, we, after a insect infestation or a wildfire, some other event like that, that we go out and we actively replant trees, and maybe we replant trees that we know are varieties that are going to grow more robustly than their just sort of wild counterparts. And we can ensure that as we manage those lands for a carbon offset project, that those trees will grow. And then in a 50, 60, 70, 80 year period of time, we're then left with a very mature stand of trees that would have very high value to folks in the timber industry. And we can use carbon offsets as a mechanism by which we start rebuilding our forest stocks, so that as we look to countries like Finland and Sweden and other areas where they have boreal forests at similar latitudes and similar climates to Alaska, we can ask ourselves, why is it that they're able to produce and harvest magnitudes of order larger board feet of timber than Alaska is on a year-to-year basis? And again, I think it comes down to they're managing their forests in ways that enable them to really build and supplement their forest industry. So in my opinion, carbon offset projects will give us that ability to look to rebuilding our forests as we also look to increase the amount of carbon that a given area of land can absorb. And I think in the mariculture space, it's also a similar story, where we have myriad applications for kelp farms and other mariculture ventures, where there's kelp that can be used for industrial processes, there's kelp that can be used for consumptive purposes, but ultimately we can use carbon offset projects as a way to enable some of those ventures to grow kelp for carbon offset purposes that again helps to supplement and complement their existing business opportunities with other uses for the mariculture. So really, when we look at these carbon offset opportunities, we're really looking at ways of enhancing and building up existing industries and business opportunities here within the state. In addition, of course, the state gets to enjoy a revenue stream, either through leasing our state lands to entities that plan on utilizing them for carbon offset purposes, or through state-led projects where we're actually developing our own lands and developing and managing them for carbon offset purposes and then enjoying the economic value that would come from that. So really, we see this as an exciting way to grow and diversify our economy, add a new stool of carbon management to our arsenal of resources that we can deploy to help grow our permanent fund, to help increase state revenues and provide more jobs and opportunities for Alaskans. So we really appreciate your willingness to take up this bill, and we look forward to working with you guys and answering your questions as we move forward with the process. And I believe Rena Miller is up, and she'll be able to walk us through the specifics of the bill. But I'm certainly happy to answer any questions while I'm here.
Do we have any questions for Commissioner Boyle by members of the committee? If not, thank you very much for presenting this morning. We'll have Rena Miller come up, please. Identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Chairman Olson and members of the committee. We appreciate the opportunity to be here today to talk to you about Senate Bill 48. For the record, Rena Miller, Special Assistant in the Commissioner's Office, Department of Natural Resources. The Commissioner, I think very eloquently gave you an overview of the general purpose of the bill as we look to that growing demand for projects that reduce or remove carbon from the atmosphere, using, of course, these nature-based solutions to help accomplish that reduction goal.
Ms. Miller, before you go on, I'd like to make an announcement that we had initially had public testimony slated for this morning's presentation, but because of time constraints, we're probably not holding public testimony. We will be delaying public testimony until this afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Miller. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In this slide, we've tried to provide a very simplified conceptual illustration of carbon management. And in the middle there, you'll see a source of emissions via fossil fuels, where they can be, those emissions can be captured at the point of generation and stored or sequestered or set aside for future use. And of course, that's the topic of another piece of legislation. What we're talking about here are more those emissions, a way to manage some of those emissions that folks don't have as much direct control over. So on the left, you'll see a cartoon of a power plant generating power. We'll follow that green arrow trajectory over to the far right. That's a sense then that you can, instead of securing emissions at the source, you can offset the emissions that have gone into the atmosphere by projects that withdraw them. And of course, carbon management is not quite as simple as that. There are many different types of carbon credits out there that people are engaging in. The ones that this bill focuses on are in that top left, about 9 o'clock to 11 o'clock quadrant related to forestry and land use. Commissioner Boyle spoke a little bit about the growth anticipated in the market. This slide is borrowed from a report on the voluntary carbon market by Shell and consulting group BGC, excuse me. On the left, you'll see a review of the status of the market in 2021. The far left looks at the size and the value of the compliance market. The compliance market is focused on those instances in which jurisdictions have required or mandated a cap on the sources of emissions that people can have and enabled them to trade some offsets to those emissions in order to keep underneath that cap. The voluntary market is also noted there under 2021. They were looking at about $2 billion in value, which was four times already the value of that market in 2020. Over on the right-hand side of the slide, we look at 2022 as a record-breaking year for both markets. And you'll see this notation that voluntary market is expected to be five times larger by 2030, which of course is not particularly far away. There are forecasts that indicate, again, tens of billions of dollars of growth within a relatively near amount of time. And also, as Commissioner Boyle discussed, the state has a fairly tremendous resource base, both in terms of land and living matter, that we believe can be leveraged to work in carbon offset projects that generate revenue for the state. The sheer scale is attractive from a carbon project potential. Of course, not all state land is going to be a good fit for a project. I think it's great to note here, too, the way that some of our Alaska Native corporations have really paved the way for carbon offset projects in the state of Alaska, particularly forestry projects. I think Alaska is about 34% of total issuances, credit issuances at two registries. And there are 16 Alaska projects that are going on right now, some of which began as early, I believe, as 2015 in that compliance market. Most are now focused into that voluntary market. DNR contracted with a company called ANEW to work with us on a report that evaluated some of the opportunity and potential in the state of Alaska for these carbon offset projects. We're pleased that the report affirmed the potential and affirmed the revenue potential as well. They've identified three pilot projects in that report. These are not necessarily projects that we would proceed with if the bill passes or in their current form, but we were very pleased to have that affirmation. The consultant, ANEW, will be available to present as well on the report and what some of these projects might look like. So the department sees that carbon offset projects can be beneficial to Alaska in a number of ways. There's the potential to be a new source of state revenue generated from a resource and land assets. We feel that these projects could be very compatible with existing land and resource use. We see also that there's a positive environmental impact from these projects, including potentially improved wildlife habitat additional silviculture applications, as the commissioner discussed, that bring forests into a ideal state. There's general support for the state economy. There are corporations doing business in our state today or that do business with our state today that need these credits. They need to be purchasing these because of shareholder or customer or investor demand, or potentially because they have environmental consciousness values as a corporation. When we can be a source of some of these credits, we're helping those businesses also be successful, which is good for the state's economy. As the commissioner discussed, the carbon offset projects are a nice overlay to other existing uses of our land and resources that go towards that maximum use directive in Alaska's constitution. And we wanted to point out here too that these projects don't lock up land. There's language in the bill that requires ongoing access for the public and generally allowed uses, things like hunting and fishing and camping and whatnot. The bill also is not instituting any kind of a cap and trade program in Alaska. It is not setting emission limits for Alaska businesses. Let me talk a little bit more specifically about the bill now. The bill broadly tasks DNR with setting up that framework to support carbon offset opportunities that align with Alaska's other interests and responsibilities. This framework would be the means by which we can receive interest and evaluate it and move forward with those projects that are appropriate. The bill enables carbon offset projects on both state land and tide and shorelines. It does not authorize any particular project. The bill will provide a process, a leasing program for third parties to lease state land for carbon management purposes, and would establish the carbon offset program at DNR under the Office of Project Management and Permitting for the state to undertake its own projects. And this slide, I just want to reinforce that there's really two very distinct paths to carbon under this bill. And that first one is the leasing of state land for carbon purposes to third parties. We'll call those carbon leases. The second one are state projects where the state would be undertaking owning the project proponent of offset projects. There are different costs and revenues associated with each path, and I just want to make sure we're drawing that good line in between those two paths right now. We'll talk first about the carbon leases. This new carbon leasing program would be administered by the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, like most of the other land lease programs. It is situated statutorily within the Alaska Land Act, so that body of regulation and statute applies as well. It will involve best interest findings, including a preliminary decision that gets noticed for public comment before the state is able to award a lease. The bill does provide an alternate to the highest price at competitive auction or sealed bid process for most commercial leases. This is in order to accommodate essentially a wider range of potential state values associated with the new carbon program. And we'll talk a little bit more about that new process as we get into the bill. I want to talk a little bit about the costs here with the carbon leasing program. The activities that will have costs include the division promulgating regulations, receiving and processing applications, which would include, of course, those preliminary findings and best interest findings. They'll need to monitor the leases and ensure that conditions are met. We are anticipating a full-time permanent position for a total of 151.9 in fiscal year 24, decreasing after those first year startup costs to 149.9 in fiscal year 25 and on. We're looking for unrestricted general fund to cover that position until the leasing revenue is sufficient to cover those costs. The bill does provide for program receipt authority toward that goal. If there's strong demand, which we certainly hope that there is for the leasing program, the department would expect to come before you again to fill out that staffing need based on that demand. The revenue associated with the leasing portion of the bill is very indeterminate in both amount and timing. It's going to be really driven by the demand of folks who want to come and lease land. their project value in the area of lands that they're interested in leasing. That said, the bill will require that lease compensation is designed to maximize returns to the state. We wanted to provide some hypothetical examples of why someone might be interested in leasing state land for a carbon management purpose. In the first example, a company may want to lease a number of acres for 55 years, which is the maximum lease term allowed under the bill. They might invest capital upfront to plant trees, regenerating a forest. It may be 20 or 30 years before those trees are of size and scale that they are able to be calculated and verified as storing carbon in order to generate credits from that project. So we're talking about something where it's capital intensive on the front end and those returns are deferred towards the later end of a project. Under this scenario, the state would likely get an annual kind of a fee for that land and then a percentage of the carbon revenue once that purpose or project is generating those credits. Another example, which I can confirm we have folks interested in Alaska today in, is potentially establishing kelp farms and overlaying a carbon offset project to help perhaps the kelp production economics or also for an environmental benefit. In this instance, perhaps the state, again, would get an annual fee for the land lease and some percentage of carbon revenue. Are there any questions, Mr. Chairman, on the leases before we move on to the state projects?
Any questions by members of the committee from Ms. Arena, Ms. Miller, Senator Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Miller, so on your hypothetical question here, let's say on the kelp farms, are these kelp farms just on state land or are these privately owned entities that would pay a sort of tax or royalty to the state of Alaska for carbon offsets?
Ms. Miller.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, thank you for the question. The bill would strictly relate to leasing of state land. So if there is a carbon project or carbon use on private land today, the state does not have any involvement. And would not under the bill.
Thank you. Not under the bill. Is that something that the state is looking at as a potential additional revenue measure to sort of have a using or can you sublease carbon offsets on state lands? So if I already have a lease, you know, just I'm a kelp farmer and or someone else and they want to offset, can they do that on state lands? Just say I'm going to sublease this out for carbon credits?
Ms. Miller.
Senator Wilson, through the chair, so someone, just make sure I'm clear on the question. Somebody already has a lease of state land and is doing a kelp project, and then they would want to sublease that to another party who would do a carbon purpose.
Yes, correct, or any other state land opportunities that may be out there.
Thank you. Division of Mining, Land, and Waters Leasing Policy Lead Jeannie Piggers is on the line, and I think she can help us address whether the division would allow a different purpose sublease the original lease is for the first purpose.
Is that Ms. Riggers?
And also to clarify, because as of now, there's no rules or regulations on carbon credits, so can someone go out and start a contract before we get this into law?
Ms. Riggers, did you hear the question?
Yes, thank you. And for the record, my name is Jeannie Piggers, Northern Regional Lands Manager and Leasing Policy Lead for the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Mining, Land, and Water. Through the chair, yes, I did hear the question, and my understanding from the first question is whether an existing lease lessee who has a kelp farm lease or some other type of state lease could then sublease for carbon purposes. So I think initially the answer to that would be eventually subleases could happen, but if an existing lease that we hold right now, like a current kelp farmer or another lessee who has received a lease from the state for some other purpose under some other statute has the lease now, there would have to be some sort of amendment to their primary lease that the state would approve prior to subleasing for a different reason. That's because when we issue leases, we do them pursuant to different statutes. And even though in future, we do in fact see potential for subleases of carbon leases, and we also now allow for subleases under existing leases, there has to be an evaluation first that the sublessee and the subleasing project is consistent with the primary leasing statute. So it wouldn't be an instantaneous sublease from an existing lease. There has to be some sort of an evaluation for an amendment first.
Follow-up, Senator Wilson?
No, thank you.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Miller, so the sections of the bill you've gone through so far are about leasing state land. So then in the descriptions, other than the kelp thing, which is a ways off, I think, in the descriptions, we've talked about trees. If the thing of value that is being the purpose for which the land is being leased is the carbon, who owns the trees?
Ms. Miller?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Keel, the state owns the trees. A lease would not automatically provide some kind of right to harvest trees. The current mechanism for that is through a timber sale, which would obviously a sale different than the lease.
Senator Keel, please.
So then with one of these leases for carbon management purposes, the ability to harvest those trees selectively thin, the things that the commissioner designee was talking about, that would be separate from the carbon management lease?
Ms. Miller?
Senator Keel, through the chair, thank you. Those are the kinds of activities that could occur most likely within that state project. But of course, one of our examples here involves a company that wants to plant new trees.
Senator Keel.
Thank you. I think what I heard, and please correct me if I heard it wrong, was that the state would have to separately sell the trees if there's to be some thinning. How about the carbon in the soils? Who owns that?
Ms. Miller.
Senator Keel, through the chair. That is a good question, and I'd like to vet that with a few folks and respond to the committee in writing.
If you could get back to us, or all the committee members, with that answer, we would appreciate it. Follow-up, Senator Keel. Senator Stedman.
I got a couple questions. I'd like to back up a little bit. This is all new, at least a lot of us. So on slide 15, you know, you're talking about doing, in this hypothetical example, 10,000 acres, and then going in and rejuvenating some of the trees. Help me with that, because it seems like if we go into land that hasn't been logged, it's in old growth status, so any alterations in that creates other issues. And then if it's already been logged, it rejuvenates itself, at least in Southeast. They don't go in and plant trees. They have another problem. They have to go in and thin them. So could you help me a little bit with that? And then I've got a habitat question.
Ms. Miller.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Stedman, understanding Southeast has some tremendous regeneration attributes. Statewide, there may be opportunities where perhaps fire has deforested an area, or in areas that otherwise can benefit from reforestation or afforestation. There are those opportunities then again to plant trees, as the commissioner stated, perhaps species that grow larger, faster, to store more carbon. We see those opportunities. Thinning again in certain areas will have the same effect of making other trees grow older and larger.
Bob Center, sir?
Yeah, just a little different question. So DNR has area plans for the state forests or state lands, and that effectively is locked up a lot of land for habitat designations if you're dealing with a black bear or whatever you want to deal with, right? And that creates some problems. So does this bill then support removing those habitat or area plans and changing them? I'm just kind of curious how that works.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, for the state forests under the bill would require forest management plan amendments in order to identify land within those forests that would be suitable or available for a carbon offset project. and then a carbon offset project proposed for one of those forests would need to comply with that forest management plan. Does that answer your question?
Close. And then I got a real basic question. Does an old growth forest store more carbon than if we clear cut it and start over again? Or, you know, and what I'm thinking of is the Haynes Forest, which is there's a lot of merchantable timber in the Haynes Forest. And I don't think we're going to go clear cut the Haynes Forest anytime soon, the way things look. So we've got that in old growth status.
Ms. Miller.
And then we have other areas in Southeast that have been already cut. So where are we better off, and what's going to capture more credit or more carbon?
Ms. Miller.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, our state forester, Helge Eng, is on the line, and I think when we're talking into those specifics of forest management, he would be a great resource for us to call on.
Would you mind going to him, Senator Stedman?
No.
Mr. Eng, Helge Eng, are you on, sir?
I am.
Since you're the
Helge Eng, state forester.
Since you're the expert.
Director of the Division of.
Since you're the expert on forests, why don't you go ahead and give an answer to Senator Stedman's question.
Can you hear me okay?
You're coming in loud and clear.
I'm Helge Eng. I'm the director of the Division of Forestry and Fire Protection and the Alaska State Forester. Through the chair, Senator Stedman, the answer is that it is a close race, and it is not possible to say equivocally one way or the other whether clear-cutting and planting new forests and storing the harvested lumber in houses for 100 years will outcompete the amount of carbon stored in old-growth forests. It is pretty close, and our projection models are not good enough to really say clearly if one is more competitive than the other.
Follow-up, Senator Stedman?
No.
Mr. Eng, one of the questions I have for you, or maybe this is a question for Ms. Miller. If you have forests that are out there that you have leased out, and say you have a fire, or if you have an infestation of spruce bark beetle, and they destroy the trees, what happens then?
Mr. Chairman, Rena Miller, for the record, are you asking if there's a carbon project and fire or beetle kill happens?
Does the, I guess my question, real question, since we're the Finance Committee, does the state still have a financial input with that, even though there's been some destruction of the forest?
Thank you, Senator Olson. So with our forests, these would be largely reserved for state projects rather than leasing forests, state forests capitalized to third parties. When you do these projects, you need to do them in a protocol, a methodology for rules provided by an entity called a registry. This is sort of an independent body that's not project and is not buyer of credits that focuses on project integrity. Part of the registry's rules and kind of project governance requires some portion of the credits generated by your project to be set aside into what they call a risk buffer. It's something akin to an insurance pool that then protects against any natural disaster, act of God, be that wildfire, infestation, wind throws, et cetera.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Stedman's question raised a follow-up for me. He talked about the habitat values, right? The commissioner designee talked about merchantability of timber as the one value out there, but if you don't have big trees below the steep slopes, you'll never have a mountain goat and won't survive the winter. Can you talk to us about how these leases and the best interest findings involve our biologists looking at game, looking at fish habitat? Are they outside of that process?
Absolutely. Through the chair, Senator Keel, if we could, I'd like to call on Jeannie Piggers again, who has practice with with the best interest findings and can best answer that question.
Ms. Biggers, did you hear the question?
Yes, I did. Thank you. And for the record, this is Jeannie Piggers. Through the chair, as far as biologists or other experts taking a look at these projects and how that plays in, during the best interest finding process for a lease, the department will prepare and send out an agency notice to our sister agencies that would have expertise or a land management interest in lands that may be being considered for a lease project. And if, in fact, the project is in an area where there would be ADF&G interest or expertise regarding things of that nature, ADF&G or other agencies that have expertise in this would be included in that agency notice. And we take that information that we receive once we've noticed other agencies and incorporate it into preliminary findings for leases. So we do avail ourselves of the expertise of our sister agencies.
Mr. Chairman, may I build on that briefly?
Please do, Ms. Moore.
Thank you. I appreciate Ms. Piggers related to the best interest finding. I think even prior to that, though, you have the forest management plans that do account for a number of resources and broader things than simply timber. And so, again, those forest management plans, a project has to first be something that can be compatible with that. Before you're even able to really take the project concept to the point of that best interest finding.
Bob, Senator Keel?
I'll hold off, thanks.
No, thank you very much. Go ahead and continue with the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we could, we'll now shift from the concept of carbon leases to third parties to state projects. Section 6 in the bill stands up that carbon offset program within DNR for the state to undertake its own carbon offset projects. Under this construct, the state is the project proponent. It owns the project. There's no leasing involved. The state may work with a partner, a project developer, potentially other contractors to actually develop that project. There are costs to start a project up and also to maintain a project through the project term. The project essentially then generates credits for verifiable emission reductions. Those, then the state, as the project proponent, can sell to buyers, potentially along with a project developer or with a marketing contracted expertise. The revenue from the sales under the bill would flow to the new carbon offset revenue fund that's also established in Section 6. And that's a very, very broad overview of the state projects.
Ms. Miller, can you just kind of give us an idea on what the timeline is from, say, bullet point 1 to bullet point 8?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. Bullet point 1 assumes that the legislation passes and the department immediately begins work on regulations and establishing this framework. We can estimate that would take a year. There may be another 6 months to a year to work through processes of soliciting concepts from people who may be interested in doing these with the state and the state identifying potential projects, evaluating and selecting which ones of those to do with all the public process that's inherent, again, in that best interest finding process. Ultimately, once you've decided to do a project, from the beginning, the feasibility analysis through the project inventory, some computer modeling for growth, design, to the point where it's generating credits is typically 18 months to 24 months. Most of that 18 to, I'm sorry.
My question has to do more with not the steps. I just want to know from bullet point 1 to bullet point 8, which is the passing of the bill to the revenue coming into the state for that.
I would estimate, Mr. Chairman, 4 years.
Thank you very much.
We talked a little bit about a registry before. With this slide, we're hoping to depict the generalized parties that would be involved in a state project. On the left, you have the project itself, and we're talking in this context about a state of Alaska project proponent. On the far right, you have buyers. These are, again, those companies with voluntary emission reduction targets. There are other buyers also, individuals, governments. These companies represent the main portion of the market. In the middle is this registry. And again, that's a nonprofit quality control entity. They're making sure that the projects are done according to set scientific protocols, including a number of calculations that are established to make sure that projects are accurately accounting for the additional carbon storage that occurs because of the project. And also they're maintaining integrity of these credits, which is very important to the buyers. The large arrow on the top, of course, the project works directly with buyers to sell credits. The registry is not involved with the sale. The registry does work towards the project by setting those rules and then issuing credits to the project when it can verify its success. The registry also works to the right with the buyers. When these credits are issued to the project, they're serialized. The registry tracks those through issuance, through transfer, and then ultimately through retirement or use when someone applies those against their emissions ledger. And that helps, again, to ensure integrity.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have examples of who some of the major buyers of companies that will be voluntary emission reduction targets?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, absolutely. To throw some of the names out there, I believe Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Disney, L'Oreal. There are a number of others. I believe there's about 2,000 companies that are currently or have been engaged in the voluntary carbon market. And when Mr. Strauss with ANEW presents, I believe he actually has a slide showing even additional to what I've been able to mention.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And would that include corporations that are owned internationally or outside the United States?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, I believe it could include. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Senator Piscitman.
On that note, are you aware of any interest in the Securities and Exchange Commission in looking at these credits and any potential rulings that may classify these as an unregistered security or any regulatory potentials coming at this new concept?
Senator Stedman, through the chair, thank you so much for the question. The SEC had been considering some regulation for corporations that might look to how they determine their emissions that they then would apply these kinds of credits against. I believe that's not yet been done, but there are ongoing discussions and progress towards some sort of SEC involvement.
So the issue has been brought up and they're looking for an answer. We'll be finding an answer, sure.
Mr. Chairman, I think so, yes. And they're really, again, focused with the corporations, how they're determining their emissions and accounting for those as they use these credits and make these claims then of reduced impact to their shareholders and investors.
Senator Stedman, follow up?
No.
Senator Wilson?
Thank you. What's the minimum acreage that most of the carbon credits these companies are currently using now?
Senator Wilson, through the chair, to some degree, that's going to depend on what kind of a project. Like, is it involving forests? Is it involving grazing or grasslands or shrubland, whatnot? For forest-type projects, my understanding is that 5,000 to 6,000 acres, but it really also then depends on what kind of trees you have on those projects. Most of them that are happening in Alaska, a number of them are quite a bit larger and maybe 100,000 or 200,000 acres in size.
And Senator Wilson?
Yeah, and I know that's not part of this bill now, but is there a way to redefine sort of our natural resources, or it's not really a mineral right in terms of carbon? I just feel that, you know, you have opportunities here to protect that as a renewable resource in our state if we can redefine that and have sort of the projects or carbon projects go through a similar leasing structure for the state of Alaska, because I can think of several entities that may have that type of land use or go out now and acquire that type of land for this opportunity.
Ms. Miller.
Senator Wilson, through the chair, I appreciate your comment. We'd be happy to discuss that more with you.
Go ahead with the presentation if there's no further questions.
So now we shift a little bit as we talked, you know, the costs and revenue under each of the paths are fairly different here. We have some fixed program costs regardless of the number of projects that the state program undertakes. The new carbon offset program, again, would be housed under the Office of Project Management and Permitting. The department is looking for two full-time permanent positions there to man that, to be able to manage the various projects and interest, conduct the best interest findings and processes, and to provide the accountability that's required under the legislation in terms of record keeping and also in terms of annual reporting to the legislature. The program would be supported by the Division of Forestry and Fire Protection, looking for one full-time permanent position there. In both instances, the department's looking for UGF to fund these positions until revenues from the projects, from the credit sales, is sufficient to replace that. At that time, the revenue that had gone into the fund could be used for those costs. We're also requesting initial capital to the Office of Project Management and Permitting to establish the framework and retain expertise that may be necessary in doing that. We're talking about some legal and commercial expertise there. Finally, along with those fixed costs, there will be some project-dependent costs. These will cover things like project feasibility analysis and implementation, ongoing project maintenance. The registries, again, for specific protocols will require ongoing inventories, ongoing modeling, ongoing audits.
Chairman. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Skeel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Miller, it's been too long since we set up OPMP. My memory has failed me. OPMP sets up RSA, charges project developers money, permit fees, RSA's money over to DEC for water quality work and fish and game for habitat biologists to look for salmon and spawning beds. Is that contemplated here, and is some of this money going to those departments? I didn't see fiscal notes from them.
Senator Keel, through the chair, thank you for the question. Not specifically contemplated through those fiscal notes. OPMP Director Ashley Adoko is on the line, and I think we can turn to her for a little bit of a more specific answer to your question.
Are you on the line, Ashley Adoko?
Yes, this is Ashley. Can I be heard?
Yes, we can hear you. Did you hear the question?
I think so. I'll do my best. This is Ashley Adoko, Office of Project Management and Permitting Director, and thank you for the question. Through the chair, representative, this would be a somewhat different framework than we typically function under in other contexts, such as when we have a mining applicant or an oil and gas applicant. They are agreeing to give OPMP money for OPMP services to them, and it's voluntary, and then they also agree through our memorandums that we have with them to reimburse our agencies who work with us in coordinating and working with them on their projects and getting them through the permitting process. And here, we wouldn't have an outside entity coming to us and coming into an agreement with us so that we could then, OPMP, that is with us, issue those funds to other agencies. So it's a different framework. Does that answer the question?
Senator Keel, follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It does answer the question. Thank you. There's always an oddity to the structure when an agency regulates itself. But I guess the question to Ms. Miller would be, are we expecting to see fiscal notes from Fish and Game DEC?
Senator Keel, through the chair, I don't want to speak for other departments. I do not, though, at this point, anticipate additional fiscal notes from those departments. For a carbon offset project, they would, again, be consulted in conjunction with a best interest finding, as I believe Ms. Piggers previously discussed. which we conceive of as something that, that can be done potentially in the course of their regular business, the consulting on that.
Mr. Chairman, Ashley Adoko is on the line answering questions for Senator Keel at this point.
Yeah, you're good with that, Senator Keel? Or
no follow-up.
Okay, thank you very much. Go ahead, Ms. Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To talk a little bit more about the project-dependent costs, we want to note to the committee that there's a variety of ways for the state to approach projects. If there is revenue in the, if there is money in the revenue fund, the state could use those funds and have state staff build and design and carry out a project, potentially with contracts from various companies that specialize in activities like inventory and computer growth modeling. The state could also contract with a project developer or developers. These developers offer a range of terms and services. One very, very common approach in the carbon offset project field is a turnkey project developer. In this instance, that company fronts the project costs. They accept the upfront risk, and they receive a fixed share of revenue once that project is generating credits. That's how they are compensated. These turnkey developers often also bring marketing expertise to the table, which can align the two parties, the state proponent and the developer, from really inception to conclusion. There are also a number of companies that provide, I guess, a la carte services, fee for services to perform specific project tasks. We have provided for the committee a couple of scenarios. These scenarios feature the potential pilot projects that are identified by ANU in their report. ANU will be able to discuss them in more detail when they are able to testify to the committee. The report and these scenarios are not meant to be conclusive of what the opportunity the DNR sees for the state here. Again, the bill doesn't approve any particular project. What we really want to do with these is to examine the potential and then move on with those that are most appropriate and beneficial for the state. The state forests are featured in these pilot projects. Their primary objectives, due to the data that's available at the time of the feasibility or the pilot report, also because of their high carbon storage potential. Ultimately, outside of these revenue crediting tables, revenue will be really dependent on a project-by-project basis. The number of projects at the moment, the timing, the size, how much carbon can we verify has been stored at any given crediting period, what the price we can receive at that time for credits is, the success that we have marketing. And again, on sale of credits, that revenue under the bill would flow into the carbon offset revenue fund. So we take a look at these tables, and I apologize, it's a lot of information on a single screen. This looks at a single project scenario, and in this instance, we're looking at a project on the Haines State Forest Resource Management Area, as described again in the ANU report. On the left, you kind of have the time period. We've used years, as the chairman previously asked. We can bump that up to a few years from now to more accurately reflect a trajectory. In the second column, total credits, these are the anticipated number of credits that the project will generate. Those credits would be issued to the project by the registry once that carbon storage has been verified. The next column related to leakage credits, the registry requires retaining at the registry 30% of the credits generated to the project to account for leakage. Leakage is essentially the concern that your project doesn't actually reduce emissions, but simply shifts them elsewhere. leakage can occur either in the market or via activity. Leakage would be an instance where a landowner maybe says that they will avoid deforesting this part of land that they own and generate carbon revenue credits from that, and instead they go and maybe deforest or clear this other portion of land. So they've just shifted their activity. The other kind of leakage at play is market leakage. This is the concern that even if you don't harvest or don't clear or harvest less intensely, you're not actually reducing the demand for timber or wood products in the market. So, of course, these are concerns by buyers that they want the emission reductions to be real and to hold up. Leakage then is something that could cause it not to be. And so the registries withdraw and hold back some of your credits to accommodate that concern to the satisfaction of those buyers. Moving on, the registry then pulls 18% of the total credits as that risk buffer that we discussed about in case of an act of God, natural event. Excuse me. Then we move in after those deductions by the registry to the total credits that the project generates. Those are broken down in both conservation credits and removal credits. Mr. Strauss with ANEW can build on this during his presentation, but generally conservation credits tend to happen more in initial years on certain forests when they represent that reduced activity on that forest through a less than maximum harvest scenario. And then the removal credits really represent removal of carbon from the atmosphere, and that represents the growth in your forests over time that is generating those credits. In the middle of the slide, we provide an estimated credit price for both conservation credits and for removal credits. You'll see that the market does value those differently. Ultimately, then, you have your gross project revenue. We've moved on to add a column for project expense. These are things, again, that are project specific and related to things like inventory and growth modeling, project papering and design. We come up with a net revenue. In the third from right column, we have the developer share. This is in that turnkey developer kind of concept, if any, meaning it may not necessarily be with a turnkey developer. 20% is a pretty standard split for developers in this business. So that's the number that we added in here. The bill does currently cap us so that the state would be able to offer no more than a 30% commission. So then we deduct the DNR program costs, and these are really to represent the fiscal notes attached to the bill. And then we end up with the state net revenue in terms of dollars. We've then provided a second slide that looks at doing three projects all at once, the Haines State Forest, Tanana Valley, and then a Mat-Su forested land project. And again, I think the big difference that you'll see, all the numbers have been adjusted accordingly, but the DNR program costs in the second column from the right remain fixed, again, because they're program and not project costs. We've talked a little bit about how the revenue from credit sales would flow under the bill into the Carbon Offset Revenue Fund. Under the current bill language, this fund is housed outside of the general fund. Revenue would flow automatically into that fund. There is shall be deposited language in the bill. The appropriation does not lapse, and it can be used for purposes of the program. I do want to note, just in full disclosure, that we understand that the Senate version language that you have before you doesn't require any further appropriation, and there needs to be an appropriation either in or out of the fund, and we're happy to work with the committee and your fund and fiscal experts to make that happen. And we'd also like to note, again, just for full disclosure, that the House Resources Committee did put a $10 million lapse in their version of this bill.
Senator Stemmer has a question.
I'm just kind of curious on why it's not in the general fund, and what the concept of there was, and then a little more detail on why the administration would want no further appropriation fingerprints from the legislature going forward.
Absolutely. As Senator Stedman, through the chair, I believe that the no further appropriation may have been something that occurred in translating the original bill into through the ledge legal drafting compliance process. Neil Steininger is on the line, and I think can talk about the desire to have that fund placed outside the general fund.
No, and I'd like to, further explanation on the general fund issue.
Mr. Steininger, are you on, sir?
Yes, I am. For the record, Neil Steininger, Office of Management and Budget. Through the chair, Senator Stedman. The desire in drafting the fund this way was to ensure that the balance of the fund wouldn't be subject to the CBR sweep. That would ensure that projects being paid for out of this fund could be relied upon in those contracts developed with industry partners that the money available in the fund to complete those projects could be relied upon crossing fiscal years.
Senator Stidman.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think most funds, small sub-funds of the general fund would like to be out of the general fund. And I think that is a issue for the committee to work on.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the uses of the carbon offset program, how do you get around the constitutional requirement that we don't have any dedicated funds? This seems to be moving directly in that direction.
Steininger.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Hoffman. The way that this was set up is designed to be similar to the bill that recently moved the Higher Education Investment Fund outside of the general fund to move it out of consideration for the sweep. So it is not a dedicated fund. It is a designated fund, similar in structure to the Higher Education Investment Fund.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wilson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I can see some of the leases being put into that, but shouldn't this be more set up like a royalty type of percentage that money should go be designated into the permanent fund for as a percentage of some of the carbon offset, but not the leases itself?
Mr. Steininger.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, that's not the way that we had contemplated originally setting up the fund, but something that we could get back to you in discussion on.
Senator Wilson?
No, Mr. Chair, just wondering in that sort of reading some of the items and depends on how we define carbon in terms of monetizing carbon as a mineral or a use of state land, just reviewing Article 8 of the Constitution, just wondering on that.
Senator Keel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was thinking along the same lines as Senator Wilson. It goes back to the question that Ms. Delbridge offered to get back to the committee on before it. Mineral resources are subject to royalty and replenishable resources are not, and it's not clear to me what this is. And we need to think about the impact that has on the fiscal structure. I had a question, I guess, for Ms. Delbridge, if we could go back to the potential project scenarios there, and I guess the contemplation here of these activities on state lands subject to leases and active management of the site, do we think that there will be some, I forget there's a name for it, but some activity subject to local property tax because of private for-profit activities on the otherwise non-taxable state land? Have we calculated that in?
Ms. Miller.
Thank you. Senator Keel, through the chair. So just as a reminder, these scenarios relate strictly to the state projects on state land, so there's no leasing or third party involved in these scenarios. And just to be clear, with the fund, also leasing revenue won't go into the fund. It's strictly for the state projects. So when when someone leases state land and then uses it for some activity, if that land falls within the boundaries of a taxable jurisdiction like a borough, the borough does have the ability then to assess and value and tax that land use. The bill doesn't change that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would be interested in a better understanding of how a turnkey operator makes that happen without creating a private interest that is taxable.
Ms. Miller, go ahead with the presentation.
Thank you. At that point, Mr. Chairman, I'm prepared to go into a sectional of the bill if you would like, or if you would like to hold on that until a future time in light of the hour.
I'd like to hold on that. If we have Mr. Joshua Strauss, Senior Vice President from ANU, if he would go ahead with his presentation. Mr. Mr. Strauss, are you on, sir?
Hello, thank you. Josh Strauss, Senior Vice President from ANU, and I've been collaborating with DNR staff for what is, you know, nearly over a year now since the beginning of the ANU report, which my team and I put together to help DNR analyze the potential for carbon projects in a number of different through a number of different avenues, forestry being what is was judged to be the most likely to be quite successful for the state, but having looked at a number of different avenues as well. So pleased to be with you all today and glad that that you've taken the time to allow me to speak. I believe that there is a presentation deck in front of the committee, and I will kind of dive into that deck. And then, you know, throughout this presentation, please do feel free to jump in with questions as you have them. I will try to move expeditiously through the slides, but I will not rush this thing. And of course, at the end, we can catch up on any other questions that folks might have.
Mr. Strauss, we have a question. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Strauss. I'd like to have you give us a little brief synopsis of your firm.
Sure. Happy to do so. That was actually going to be one of the first slides. I'll do that right now. So our company, ANU, is the largest and longest established carbon offset development company in North America. We were founded back at this point about 22 years ago. The organization has got approximately 200 folks within the group, and we have specialties in a wide variety of environmental attributes, offsets being one of the key ones of them. We have a department of the team that focuses on advisory work and helping companies get familiar with exactly, you know, what their emissions profiles look like. We also have helped folks figure out how they can reduce emissions broadly within their business line, as well as where they might source emissions reductions from external sources such as offsets. My team in particular that I run is the Natural Climate Solutions team, or NCS. We focus on all ways that we can use natural means to generate offsets and help folks reduce emissions. Over this 20 year plus period of which the company's been in business, we've developed well over 200 projects of different sorts to capture emissions reductions. Of those, over half are forestry, so well over 100 of those projects at this time. And we are helping folks manage carbon on over 6 million acres of forest land in the U.S. and Alaska, in continental U.S. and Alaska, with other projects in Canada as well. My team is at this point over 30 strong, each of which people involved in the work have at least a master's in their various environmental specialty. In the case of the folks that were working on the ANU report, all these folks had a master's in forestry or greater, several folks with actual PhDs in forest mensuration, geospatial analysis, and carbon modeling. So that, you know, that's the team in a nutshell. Me personally, I've worked in this space for about 11 years. I've been with ANU, and the company that ANU was previously known as before a name change for that entire time. My background is in forestry and environmental economics, and I have a master's in both areas. So with that, I would like to jump into sort of the broader agenda for today. And what, you know, I'm glad that having heard Rena go first, I can help add some color to a number of areas that she already touched on, and understanding that this can be a fairly complicated project type to get your head around. I think it'll probably be helpful to have a little bit of some redundancy in these presentations just to make sure that people, it really sinks in. But what I want to talk about now, since I've introduced the organization already, I want to talk a little bit about the difference between compliant and voluntary carbon offset markets, which is relevant for an understanding of the space, though the voluntary opportunity is truly the opportunity of concern and relevance here. Then I'll talk about just ideas of what makes a good carbon offset, what defines offset quality, which is, you know, a key concept in this marketplace. Then spend some time talking about the Alaska pilot projects themselves, what ANEW went through to try and suss out the potential carbon value on these select three forested areas. And then lastly, just talk a little bit about the core development process, you know, what really goes into bringing one of these projects from a concept all the way through to actually generating the credits and revenue for the state. And then we can move to questions. With that, I think I would just jump to that slide that I saw briefly up on the video, just the existing forest carbon projects in Alaska. I wanted to know, and Rena mentioned it as well, that there's 16 functional forest carbon projects in Alaska right now that are up, running, generating credits, generating revenue for various landowners, many of which are the Alaskan Native corporations that are operating within the state. So this isn't something, if the DNR was to engage, this isn't something that would be, you know, brand new kind of really, really bleeding edge stuff. It's a process that has been, you know, undertaken by a number of different corporations, organizations, and been successful. The ones on the map are just the ones that ANEW has done. But I would focus to say that, you know, beyond that, there are fully 16 projects that are operational and successful. About two thirds of them are in the compliance market, and about one third are in the voluntary market. And ANEW has led on the development of most of those voluntary ones. But so then from there, we can jump right into, you know, what is the voluntary versus compliance market and what are the differences? So if you want to move forward two slides. And forgive me, there's a little bit of a lag on the video. So I'm watching in real time through the video channel, which I definitely think is a little bit behind in terms of, you know, what's happening in real time. So to discuss these two markets, so the voluntary market versus the compliance. Well, I'll start with compliance. And compliance is, as the name would suggest, there's actually a regulatory basis for folks participating in this. It means that, you know, the companies that are buying credits in a compliance market, the most understood or the most common one for considering forest credits being the California program. Folks within that program are obligated to meet certain emissions reductions levels per state regulation. As a result, they can purchase credits and purchase offset credits to meet a certain portion of those emissions reductions that they need to maintain. In that marketplace right now, you currently see pricing of offset credits generally fluctuating between $17 and $25. And there is built-in demand in that California program going all the way through 2030. I won't spend too much time on that because it's not particularly relevant in this case, because the Alaska project on Alaskan public land will not be eligible to generate credits in this marketplace. It's based on some of the calculation processes. It just isn't feasible to do so. But wanted to make sure folks on the committee at least knew that this was considered and taken into account. There's future compliance programs that are just getting underway or have potential to be in motion. The Washington program is a new program. Oregon has been very close to putting in place a cap and trade program in the past and has some of its own, you know, regulated processes for addressing emissions reductions. And then as you think more broadly, there's a international aviation program known as CORSIA, and then Canada broadly has some programs of its own. So that is an active marketplace. But for the sake of the discussion today, we should really focus on the voluntary market. And voluntary really means just that the folks who are purchasing the credits, those are those large those companies that were mentioned before, the sort of, and I believe that it was first even discussed by the commissioner when he first introduced the topic, just the idea that it's hard to watch the news in a given week now and not hear about some major corporation making a commitment to reach net zero or reduce their emissions within the next, say, by 2030, 2040, or 2050. So those are the buyers that are really driving this. And you do see quite a bit more variation in pricing in that marketplace, I think particularly just because it isn't a mandated process, right? So you have folks who are willing to pay different amounts for different units. But really important to understand is that these units will sell. Fundamentally, people are interested in the emissions reductions associated with them, right? One unit is one ton of carbon dioxide equivalent. But people will pay more or less depending on other attributes associated with the credits. For example, projects with more charisma, specifically forestry projects where there are air quality issues, erosion control, habitat that's provided, you know, all these other meaningful benefits that may not be as distinctly quantified, but also, you know, provide real meaningful value, that can help encourage folks to be willing to pay more. And generally what we're seeing for credits that are developed in the United States based on forest management, you're seeing kind of pricing that's in that $15 to as much as, you know, $30 and above range. The stuff that's in the lower value chain are usually credits that have less of those additional those associated charismatic attributes, you know, maybe something like a landfill gas flare or something of that sort, that companies doesn't look quite as good on the corporate responsibility report when you're talking about all the additional benefits of the actions you've taken. The demand is less certain, obviously, because the folks, you know, the commitment itself is not built in by any kind of law. But I will say that if you are one of the major corporations who are purchasing these things at this point, and if you go to the next slide, this gives a pretty good collection of those. These are all examples of organizations that ANU has worked with in the past, but there's a much, much longer list. If you look at these organizations, like they are all beholden to their shareholders. They have significant.
Mr. Strauss, you're going to have to stop between every slide to make sure there's no questions. We do have several questions that are already here. Senator Stedman.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Several years.
Apologies. I'll be sure to do so.
Good, Senator Stedman.
Mr. Chairman, several years ago in the country, we had markets that developed in the swap arena in the financial markets, and they were not very well regulated, and they had non-standard contracts. And this appears to be something that potentially could be a cousin to it. So are these standardized contracts? And then what is your feedback dealing with the Securities and Exchange Commission reviewing this whole industry? Because it does appear to be very similar to the old swap market that virtually collapsed the financial economy.
Mr. Strauss.
Yep. So through the chair to Senator Stedman, the contracts that are involved in the purchase of these units are generally bilateral contracts, say, between a developer and an individual entity that wants to purchase them. For example, you know, based on these companies here, like let's say Nestle wanted to buy credits from ANU, we would have a bilateral contract under which they buy them, then they could take those units and retire them for the purposes of meeting their emissions reductions. If they so chose, they could sell those credits on to another buyer who might want to retire them themselves. But ultimately, any time a credit is actually retired, that's the only time it can be used and is taken into account by that one organization. The contracts themselves are not a standardized form. It's simply an agreement between parties where someone says, I'm willing to sell you this at X price, and then the other party is willing to pay at Y price, and the deal will be between the two organizations. Now, as far as the SEC's analysis of the entire marketplace, that's something that is currently under review. And as Rena mentioned, or as Ms. Miller mentioned in her presentation, the key focus at this point has been on the reporting for these various organizations, how they're actually accounting for their own emissions profile. And I believe that, you know, so any kind of examination of what the various, any deep dive into the various offsets that are used to help address those is going to be a further on process that I can't opine on when that will take place.
Bob, Senator Stedman.
So they are non-standard contracts. I think that's a short answer to that question. The IRS review, has the IRS taken any interest in this industry along with the Securities and Exchange Commission? Are they not interested.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, at this point, I am not aware of any active IRS review of the use of these voluntary market carbon credits.
Senator Stedman? No, but Mr. Chairman, I think that's something that the committee needs to understand, both what's going on in the Securities and Exchange Commission, and if that is an accurate statement that the IRS has no interest in reviewing this. Senator Wilson?
Yes, Mr. Chair, just a quick question here on page slide 6. What's your measurement of unit that you're using these prices for, where you say 4 to 35 and 17 to 24? Is that per acre of carbon credit to be used? Is that per carbon credit? Is that per carbon ton? Just trying to get the standard measurement of unit for the general pricing.
Mr. Strauss.
Yeah, absolutely, through the chair. The unit that we use is one offset equals one metric ton of emissions reductions. So whenever you hear someone say a credit, an offset, it's always one metric ton of CO2e.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wilson? If not, Mr. Strauss, with all apologies, we have to go ahead and adjourn at 11 o'clock to go on the floor. So if it's okay with you, we'll go ahead and finish up this afternoon. So this concludes this morning's agenda. This afternoon, we'll be hearing Senate Bill 52 by the Education Committee, and after that, we'll go ahead and hear the rest of the presentation by Mr. Strauss. With that, we're adjourned at 11 o'clock.